Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'd like to wish you all a very happy and peaceful New Year. Thanks so much for joining me. In today's broadcast, I'll be taking a look at some of the highlights of Pope Benedict XVI's year, offering you a bird's eye view of the popes of the 20th century who came before him, and bringing the new year in with our popular Latin lover. Well, let's begin then with Pope Benedict's year in review. That's with Australian Jesuit Father Gerald O'Collins. Father O'Collins, I'd like to take a look with you at Pope Benedict's year. There seems to be a recurrent theme, perhaps hope. Let's recall how in May he travelled to Latin America to what he referred to as the continent of hope. It was on the occasion of the 5th General Conference of CELAM, the Latin American Episcopal Conference. In your opinion, what came out of this pastoral journey and this meeting hosted by Brazil?
Well, Brazil's the biggest Catholic country in the world. There's nearly 200 million people, and the overwhelming majority of them are Catholics. He spoke in Portuguese, which was very pleasing, once in Spanish, but on the other occasion in the language of the country, in Portuguese. And he showed a strong concern for solid marriages and happy family life. I think that was very important, and also giving encouragement to the bishops of Latin America and the Caribbean. Just the sheer fact that he wanted to turn up at their 5th General Conference is significant and crucial right in itself.
Then, of course, Father, in July he wrote a letter to Chinese Catholics. This too was intended as a hopeful document, no? It opened new prospects for reconciliation among the country's divided communities. Would you agree?
Oh, I would. I thought, for me, that was the other great landmark of 2007 in the life of Benedict XVI, that long letter he published in July, a letter addressed to the Catholics in China. It came out in traditional and modern Chinese as well as in other languages, and it showed his deep desire to normalize relations with the government of China. And that letter already is beginning to have some effect. It's extremely important. He's dealing there with the biggest country in the world, and not just a very large country in Asia.
Talking about letters, Pope Benedict was in turn the recipient of a letter in October addressed also to the heads of other Christian churches and signed by no less than 138 Muslim scholars and indeed later endorsed by many others. The letter called for new efforts at Christian-Muslim dialogue. This time he was at the receiving end of a message of hope, no?
He's reaching out too interreligiously towards Muslims. That's a very important item on his agenda now and right through the year. That was another crucial cause that he'd been supporting vigorously.
Ecumenical dialogue was one of his priorities at the beginning of his pontificate. He said he was fully determined to encourage every initiative that seemed appropriate for promoting contacts and understanding with the representatives of the different churches and ecclesial communities. So how, in your opinion, did he fare this past year in terms of ecumenical dialogue?
Certainly that was one of the things that he underlined when he became Pope back in April 2005, the doing his best in the ecumenical movement. It's a difficult task nowadays because lots of people, generous people, find that they want to commit themselves to other issues like climate change and trying to do something about global warming and so on. The kind of fire's gone out of the ecumenical movement somewhat. Many young people are deeply concerned about that. And, well, the Pope's speaking to that as well. I mean, he's telling them, you know, go green before it's too late, or being green as being pro-life. I was very struck by his speech to several hundred thousand young people last August when he insisted that protecting creation is a major task. And he's also practicing what he preached there by putting solar panels on the roof of the Vatican. But one can't ignore the continuing importance of the ecumenical movement unless Christians get together more than we have been in the past. I mean, how can we be credible when we reach out to Islam or when we tell the world, go green before it's too late and so on? We have to show a common front there.
You mentioned some of his concerns, climate change as being one of his concerns. There were other concerns as well, weren't there? Like Africa, for example.
Oh, he's continued to show deep concern for Africa. Pope John Paul II was one of the greatest friends Africa's had in the 20th century. But Pope Benedict is reaching out and speaking up for Africa, Africa that's been plundered so much and suffers so much. And in his book on Jesus of Nazareth, he applied the parable of the Good Samaritan to Africa. It was a brilliant, daring application of that parable to a whole continent that's a continent of such a great growth in Christianity, but also great suffering.
Another major concern, perhaps, was the progressive nuclear weapons ban. No, would you say that?
Oh, I'm very glad to find him urging governments to work on a progressive ban on nuclear weapons, that we should get rid of them from our world. It's not enough to say, look, we don't want other countries to have nuclear weapons. What about the countries that possess them en masse, scaling down and eventually moving towards a world that's free of those horrible nuclear weapons?
You know, since the beginning of this pontificate, Pope Benedict is often referred to, here in Italy anyway, as il Papa della Parola, the Pope of the Words. Don't you think this is a bit limiting?
He's a Pope of words, sometimes of gestures. I mean, this last year, 2007, his words came out in two very significant publications, one private, one in his role as Pope. Back in April, he published that lovely personal book, Jesus of Nazareth. He's the first Pope who's ever published a book on Jesus, and it sold already over 2 million copies. I'm delighted to see it in airport bookstores. They're on sale, bringing, you know, his message, personal message about why Jesus is just desperately important to all of us, to any readers.
You've obviously read Jesus of Nazareth. What was special about that book?
He says he started writing the book, strictly speaking, back about 2002 or 3, but there are sections in that book that come out of his preaching over the past decades. There's some lovely rounded sections there on the parables of Jesus, on the symbols in John's Gospel, and on the Sermon on the Mount. Some of those sections in that book go into preaching very easily, and I hope priests and others around the world are using it for that purpose. But it struck me reading those sections that he was giving us the fruit of a lifetime of preaching on Jesus and talking about him in a pastoral, priestly situation.
And at the end of November, Pope Benedict released an encyclical, the second of his pontificate, no, which focuses entirely on the theme of hope, as the Latin title Spe Salvi indicates.
It's been the first encyclical a Pope's ever written on hope. I mean, Popes have written numbers of encyclicals on things like social doctrine and so forth, but on the precise theme of hope in our suffering world, this is the first time a Pope's ever put out an encyclical. So it has a special importance, and it's all him, too. It's all Benedict XVI. His first encyclical on love, God is love, the first part was Pope Benedict, but the second part he was reworking material from John Paul II. So it had two parts which, yes, hung together, but this time round we've got a seamless encyclical, all Benedict, and all on the theme of hope, and encouraging us to practice that tough virtue in a world of great pain and suffering.
You say all Benedict. Benedict's style is very special, isn't it?
Well, it's very interesting to take that encyclical and read it in the light of his 1977 book on hope, eschatology, the final things. There are a straight line from some things in that book to his encyclical. The book's much longer, of course, but you can see themes that he's developed. Sometimes they're there more briefly in 1977. For example, his dialogue with the great Frankfurt School. There were some intellectual Jewish thinkers, Adorno, Horkheimer, who were very distinguished people in the 20th century indeed in European and world thought, and he enters into dialogue with them a little bit in 1977, but much more in his encyclical. They ask the right questions, and he thinks that our hope for resurrection and the general judgment gives us the answer. The victims of this world do not lose out to the perpetrators. The perpetrators of great evil will not be seen to triumph in the end. And it's a very important message, not vindictive, but God's justice must be done.
Father, we know that one of the Pope's jobs, actually, he spends a lot of time doing that, is to receive people in general, but sometimes very important people, like heads of states. Is there any particular visit that stands out, do you think?
I've always been very glad when popes have welcomed heads of state and all kinds of people. That doesn't mean they necessarily agree with all they're saying and doing, but I think a part of the job of a pope, part of his job description is precisely that. And this past year, 2007, President Putin was there in the Vatican to see Pope Benedict in March, and a bit later Gordon Brown, not yet British Prime Minister, he came by as well. So I'm very glad to see him doing just that. About 170 nations have got a diplomatic relationship with the Vatican. It's part of the extraordinary moral power that the papacy can wield in the world. It's no longer a state with an army, a military force, but it's got a moral leadership that's second to none. And so receiving the heads of states from around the world is part of the Pope reaching out in terms of faith and ethics, moral, and giving leadership in that area to the world.
Our thanks there to Jesuit Father Gerald O'Collins, author of over 50 books, among them Jesus, Our Redeemer, published by Oxford University Press, and Pope John Paul II, A Reader, published by Paulist Press. And now moving on in the programme, I'd like to bring you a feature relating to the popes who preceded our Roman pontiff, beginning with the first to be elected in the 20th century. Do stay tuned, but watch the change of pace and tone. Since canonised a saint, he's Papa Giuseppe Sarto, who took the name of Pius X when he was elected to the See of Peter on the 4th of August 1903. A man who was then described by one of the cardinals who elected him, Cardinal Mathieu, a father and a shepherd. Interestingly, this view of a pope who would be more of a father and a shepherd and less of a politician was also shared by the Catholic rulers of that time in Europe. In 1903, they still exercised their right of veto over the choice of a Roman pontiff. It was to be for the last time, ironically one of the first gestures of the very man they had chosen as pope was to remove this ancient privilege from them. When this pope died in the summer of 1914, Europe was at war. People said he died of a broken heart. The idea of a great war had proved too much for him to bear. And when the cardinals gathered in conclave to elect a new pope, the man they chose to play that capital and unprecedented role which the war offered to the Holy See proved no fortuitous choice. He was an experienced diplomat. His name was Giacomo della Chiesa, and taking the name of Benedict XV, he was elected to the See of Peter on the 3rd of September 1914. And the war he fought so hard to stop finally ended 4 years into his pontificate at the 11th hour of the 11th day of November 1918, leaving 40 million dead. Pope Benedict XV rejoiced. His war pontificate was over. Since 1914, he'd written 3 encyclicals about peace. The name of the third pope of the 20th century was Achille Ratti, who took the name of Pope Pius XI. Elected on the 6th of February 1922, his first gesture was unexpected. A pope had not appeared on the balcony looking out towards St. Peter's Square, towards the Italian state, since 1870. He was the pope who would settle the Roman question by signing the Lateran Pacts. But he was also the founder of our radio station, and that's why, since the time of Pius XI, we have recordings of all the pope's voices. Beginning with an appeal for peace he himself made in September 1938, exactly a year before the outbreak of the Second World War.
La trepidazione di tanti nostri figli.
We were in France there, and a radio message it must have been. Yes, it was when there was tension with Hitler already in 1938.
Rosminian Father Charles Leroux recalls hearing this message in Paris as a young man.
In that message, he offered to God his life in exchange for peace for humanity.
That call for peace on the part of Pius XI was repeated many times by the Pope who followed him, Pius XII. Papa Pacelli was elected on the 2nd of March 1939, and war raged throughout most of his pontificate. Less than a month after the outbreak of the Second World War, Pius XII published his first encyclical, Summi Pontificatus, on the unity of human society. In the encyclical, the new Pope branded racial prejudice as the most pernicious of modern errors and condemned, quote, the forgetfulness of that law of human solidarity dictated by the equality of rational nature in all persons to whatever people they belong, unquote. On October the 28th, 1939, in Britain, the Times commented on the encyclical under the headline, New Idolatry Condemned. And across the Atlantic, the New York Times carried an almost identical headline.
Pope condemns persecution.
The New York Times editorial ran as follows.
The voice of Pius XII is a lonely voice in the silence and darkness enveloping Europe this Christmas. He is about the only ruler left on the continent of Europe who dares to raise his voice at all.
The regal Pope Pius XII was succeeded by a very different-looking pope, gone down in history as good Pope John. But while this pope may have written an encyclical on peace, pacem in terris, he's gone down in history for a very different reason.
We were all taken aback when we saw how small Pope John was. He seemed a kind of little miniature sort of person in comparison with the figure of Pius XII. This stubby little character seemed a complete contrast with Pius XII.
In those years, Monsignor Charles Burns was studying for the priesthood in Rome.
And certainly what we didn't for a moment suspect was that within 2 or 3 months, when was this? He was elected the end of October of 58. And 25th of January 59, he calls the Ecumenical Council.
Extraordinary.
Well, I mean, that morning, coming down to the Gregorian with all the newspapers, all the headlines, Ecumenical Council called.
Il convenire odierno del Sacro Collegio Cardinalizio, della prelatura e del popolo romano in questa Basilica di San Paolo fuori le mura.
He did this on his own. Even his Secretary of State, as far as I know, Cardinal Tardini, didn't know about this.
Carmelite Father Redemptus Vallerbeck was also a seminarian at that exciting time in the history of the Catholic Church.
And the cardinals were astounded. I remember one of them thought he was hearing things. He couldn't believe it. They had spoken about a council under Pius XII, but they had decided against it because it was complicated. And, of course, you stir up things that sometimes it's better left lie fallow. So I think they felt if Pius XII, who was an intellectual, couldn't handle it and didn't feel that it was the right time, you know, how would this rather simple man do it? But that was what he called the inspiration of the Spirit. He felt that the Spirit was calling him to do that, to let a bit of fresh air into the church, and to open up windows. And he has used that expression, and I think he meant it literally, to open up new venues for the church.
Venerabiles fratres, gaudet mater ecclesia, quod singulari divine providentiae munere, optatissimus iam dies illuxit.
And when Pope John XXIII died, his successor, Giovanni Battista Montini, who took the name of Paul VI on the 21st of June 1963, found himself with the delicate task of closing and implementing the Second Vatican Council. He was not always understood.
He was very gentle, and he was a gentleman. Perhaps the world didn't quite understand him.
William Wakefield Baum, created cardinal by Pope Paul VI. The world Paul VI lived in was a changing world, the same inhabited by America's first Catholic president, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, with whom he'd met less than 2 weeks into his pontificate.
Standard of living for you citizens.
But while the young American president's world was modern, vital, and projected into the 21st century, the newly elected Pope's world was deeply anchored into the past, rife with pomp and circumstance. A situation Paul VI was determined to change when, in a symbolic gesture, he cancelled one of the Catholic Church's centuries-old traditions by giving away the Triple Crown. And again, when this last pope ever to be crowned brought it upon himself to become the first pilgrim pope. But despite these gestures of hope, the decade and a half of his pontificate was also marked with a string of situations of conflict for which Pope Paul VI had anticipated an impelling plea for peace in October 1965, as Archbishop John Foley recalls.
It was the first visit of a pope to the United Nations. Even some of the people from communist states felt the power of what he was saying.
And that takes us to 1978, the year gone down in history as the year of the three popes. I'll read you a list of dates that eventually led to the election of Pope John Paul II. On the 16th of October of that same year. August the 6th, Giovanni Battista Montini, Pope Paul VI, dies in Castel Gandolfo at the age of 81, after a 15-year pontificate. August 26th, the Cardinal Patriarch of Venice, Albino Luciani, is elected Pope, taking the name of Pope John Paul I. September 28th, the bells of St. Peter's toll to let the world know the newly elected Pope is dead. Barely a month had gone by since they had tolled for Pope Paul VI, and people listened in disbelief. People like Cardinal William Wakefield Baum, one of the members of the very College of Cardinals to elect Pope John Paul I.
One of my priests called me, and he said, "The Pope has died." And my first reaction is, "You're mistaken. You must have been listening to a program about the death of Pope Paul VI.
He had been reading one of his homilies. I was there.
Bishop John McGee, personal secretary to Pope John Paul I.
He wanted to refresh his mind, because now that he was Pope, he would have to give many homilies.
We are sons and daughters. It is about love that I want to speak to you today.
His pontificate, although brief, was, from our point of view, a moment of grace. He again appeared to everyone as a very loving father.
Our Heavenly Father wants us perfect like this.
And when Pope John Paul II was elected as the 263rd successor of Peter, his pontificate was to last for over a quarter of a century. It was he who led the Catholic Church into the third millennium. I hope you enjoyed that collage relating to all of the popes of the 20th century. Finally, it's time to join our popular Latin lover. As you know, he's Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, and he helps us bring the new year in today. Father, you have your tome of Leo the Great. He was one who spoke out against pagan Christmas, didn't he?
Yes, because the pagan customs were still very strong. This is 100 years after Christmas.
And pagan habits in the new year.
His
new year resolutions. Tell me about Leo the Great's new year
resolutions. You should read on Leo the Great, where he says we should concentrate not on stupid penances and things, but on good works, works of charity. You can't believe it.
How do you say that in Latin? How do you say new year's resolutions?
Well, Novi anni proposita.
It's like turning a new leaf. They have no expression like that, the Latins. I caught you out there. How do you say turning a new leaf?
Well, you say vertere paginam, change the page. Vertere paginam, okay, you can change the page. At novum incipere annum, and begin a new year.
Did they actually...
They didn't think in those terms.
They didn't think in those terms.
Like New Year's resolutions, not too, man. No, they didn't have that. The Romans didn't.
But they had a different calendar, we know that. So they wouldn't have celebrated New Year when we do anyway.
No, no. Although their government offices began January 1st.
So it was the beginning of the new parliamentary.
Yeah, I mean, that was like their fiscal, or what should I say, legal year was January 1st. That much they realized.
Mm. How do you say that in Latin?
What? Tantum intellex erunt, huh?
What does that mean?
So much they understood, munias, incipienda esse calendis januarius, that the offices must be begun on the 1st of January.
They had a very sophisticated system, legal system, didn't they?
Oh, yeah. Well, the Roman law.
Which has come down to us today.
Well, I don't know, to us. It depends on where I'm talking. The English American.
We have the common law. We have the common law.
Yeah, which is not so much. Yeah,
here in Italy, they still have Roman law.
Oh, yeah, that's on the continent.
Mm.
The Anglo thing is not so much Roman. You say that your common law. But all the other countries, and that means South America and everything.
How would you say common law?
Well, jus commune. Mm.
And whereas Roman law, how did they call it?
Well, it was Lex Romana, Lex Romana, which, they're using, other nations are using that.
Did they have any special ways to celebrate the opening of the parliamentarians' year?
No, there was like an oath and people were there. No, it wasn't different. The Romans didn't do things like that too much.
They were kind of square.
They would have a sacrifice or something, you know, for the blessing of the gods, and then get
them
out.
How was this sacrifice? How did it take place?
Well, I mean, they would have an animal or something like that, and up in Jupiter's altar there on the Capitoline Hill, and I have a book that I'm going to read now during Christmas, all about the prayers in Virgil and Livy. Beautiful, beautiful, interesting.
Like prayers for sacrifice.
Prayers of anything. Oaths and prayers and petitions. And
what did they speak about?
Well, they had the same thing. It's notable or extraordinary. I mean, they're humans like ourselves. And so they were asking for good weather. They were asking for peace. They were asking for good health and prosperity.
So how would you say
that? That's that famous thing where you say the famous expression, you know, mens sana in corpore sano. Well, that's part of what Juvenal says.
People, a healthy mind in a healthy body.
Yes, and he says people shouldn't go around and ask the gods for strange things. They should go to a shrine and ask the gods that there may be for them a healthy mind and a healthy body. That's where the expression comes in. It's very nice, the whole context. Because the context is you shouldn't be praying for nonsense. Huh?
How do you say nonsense in Latin?
Nuge, ineptie, okay.
Inept.
Yeah, ineptie, things which are out of place. Nugae, frivolities, frivolities, or whatever you're going to call them. No, but and so that was very serious. And so he said you should go to church instead of praying for all this nonsense, or even about helping you or killing your brethren and all that stuff. Go and pray that you may have a healthy mind and a healthy body.
Heartfelt thanks, as always, to our popular Latin lover. He's Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, and he's currently working at the Vatican's Secretariat of State as the Pope's own Latinist. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'd like to wish you a very happy new year once again. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. You're tuned to Vatican Radio, Laudetur Jesus Christus.